All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and the Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-7127. Construction Corporation USA and Dima Engineering and Construction Incorporated, a joint venture of Columbus and the Washington Metropolitan Area and
Good morning, Your Honors. Of course, as you've heard, my name is Jerome Reese, and of course, I represent the appellant here. The problem is that the issues which this court must determine were created by the administrative court and affirmed by the district court. Those issues were really not created by the parties themselves. And in doing so, I would submit to your honors that these courts ignored contract provisions, ignored Rule 4 of the Armed Services Board of Contract Appeals, ignored the contents of the record itself, even ignored decisions rendered by the contracting officer of WMATA. And we have a situation in here in which, in actuality, the courts substituted their views for that of the contracting officer and Kiska. And let me explain more specifically, please. Of course, we're dealing with two major issues, one being monies withheld of $650,000, which had been earned by Kiska during the performance of the contract. And the other is what is called Pending Change Order 56. Now, with respect to the retainage itself, there is a procedure outlined regarding claims in the contract and administratively. The contract basically provides that in the event the claim is made, the contracting officer shall indicate in a rejection the reasons for his rejection. If you look at those reasons closely, one of them is that the claim itself is untimely. Understanding untimely is the fact that in the contract, time, that is statutory time for a particular claim, arises following the final completion of the contract. That is 100% complete, not 99.7% or 99.9%, 100% complete. In addition to that, if you look at the record, the sole witness of WMATA testified that he saw a final completion certificate. If there is a final completion certificate, and indeed the job is complete 100%, raising an issue with respect to incomplete punch list work is certainly the creation of the administrative court.
How can the job be 100% done if there's still a punch list?
There is no punch list. That's the point.
I thought the reference, there was a reference to the punch list that either accompanied or post-dated the what you're saying is the
substantial
final
completion certificate, which was as early in November 1997 from an individual who was not present at the end of the job, indicated at that time there was a punch list. And that, and by the way,
there was meeting minutes, pardon me, later than that.
There were meeting minutes which referred specifically to items of a punch list. The last meeting minutes in April of 1998, although it had a heading, punch list attached, there was no punch list attached. In addition, let me point out that Rule 4.
But that's the last meeting. There were some others, too.
Not after April of 1998, sir.
After your man left the job.
Yes.
So you're pointing to the time of his departure and saying there was the job was completed by then.
No, I'm saying after that, because there was a payment made in July of 1998, which was between $300,000 and $400,000. So clearly work was being performed after November of 1997.
So how are we supposed to know when it was really final? When 100% of the work was done?
Very simple. Rule 4 requires that the WMATA submit all material and relevant documents, which would have included, in connection with this case, any document which showed that the punch list work was incomplete. We know, of course, as a matter of fact, that the project has been in operation for more than 10 years, and there has been no claim in any of the pleadings, no claim in any of the affidavits or the motions making reference by WMATA for incomplete punch list work. And I would remind Your Honor of this very interesting fact. With respect to one of the reasons given by the administrative court for the non-payment of the retainer was the fact that there had been no voucher submitted by Kiska. When you look at the contract expressly says that after the job is complete, not substantially complete, that at that time a voucher is supposed to be issued by the contractor. And of course,
issued by
the voucher is sent in by the contractor.
Okay.
We had initially argued that it would have been a futile act. And we attempted to prove that by, in fact, subsequently submitting a voucher, which went unanswered. And that is true. It was done afterwards. But it's in the record because there was a motion to dismiss it, and the motion was denied. But without prejudice, nevertheless, it's in the record at this time. But how could you say that there's work incomplete when you're saying that the contractor is supposed to present a voucher to WMATA?
I guess it was the administrative authority of the board, or maybe it was the district court, said it was your burden, right, to show that the work was complete.
But the point is, how do you prove a negative?
Well, I think that's a good question.
And the fact remains that all the evidence in the record, all the position of the parties involved basically that the job was complete. There wasn't a single document from WMATA, which it was obligated to present before the Armed Services Board pursuant to Rule 4, that there was incomplete work. There's no way that we could see that WMATA had ever said that there was incomplete work of punch list. And we do know that after the substantial completion date, which did list the number of punch list items to be completed, that there was a payment made as late as July of 98. And keeping in mind punch list work, minor work, it may be just cleaning up some paint. It may be something with respect.
Well, that payment was for about $330,000.
That's correct.
So,
but
that was presumably for some punch list work, right?
That was for the punch list work.
And there's still another $650,000 outstanding.
No, the $650,000 is monies that had already been earned and had been withheld.
Okay, gotcha.
Now, I see my time is up, but I haven't touched the punch list, pending change order 56. So
you're welcome to do so on rebuttal. Unless there are questions about that. Okay, we'll wait for the rebuttal on that.
Thank you, sir. Excuse me.
Good morning, Your Honors. Donald Laffert for the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. This case involves two simple claims that arose under a contract between WMATA and Kiska for the construction of the Green Line and the 14th Street tunnels. The contract was entered into by the parties in 1994 for an approximate amount of $47 million. The two claims at issue the retainage claim and the tunnel safety walk claim are approximately $900,000. This court has already touched upon it, but this is a burden of proof case. The board reminded Kiska that this was a burden of proof case, that they had to prove entitlement to their claims. The issues are straightforward and clear.
As a burden of proof matter, why isn't the burden on WMATA to say what it is that remains undone? We have said that we follow the Court of Federal Claims on topics such as this. Are you familiar with the PCL case?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Well, that's too bad. It says this was a set-off case. It's analytically, I think, indistinguishable from this one. In deducting from a contractor's earnings, the government carries the burden of proof to show that its actions were correct, citations. As the Court of Claims stated, the government has the burden of proving how much of a downward adjustment in price should be made, just as the contractor has that task when an upward adjustment is sought under the changes clause, close quote. While the defendant has introduced into evidence numerous punch list items, the government has never assigned costs to those items and therefore didn't carry its burden of proof as to its right to retainage. Because the defendant has failed to provide the basis for the amount of retainage, the court finds the defendant has failed to meet its burden of proof on this issue. So that court's pretty clear that a claim of incomplete work as a justification for withholding money is tantamount to a government claim, and the government has the burden of proof on it. Now, putting aside the burden of proof question, it would seem to me that you would at least have the burden of coming forward with whatever it is that's incomplete.
Well, Your Honor, I think I can distinguish that case. We did not make an affirmative claim that we were entitled to keep the money. We never made that claim. It was Kiska's burden under the contract under Section 7F to prove that it had completed. WMATA never said that it was entitled to keep the money. This is a burden of proof case where Kiska, there's nowhere in the record that Kiska said they completed the work. If you scour the record, and Mr. Reese provides no evidence where any single Kiska witness stood up and said, we completed the work, we're entitled to this money. In fact, Kiska's sole witness on the issue of retainage, Mr. Price, said he didn't know whether the work was completed.
As of the time he left.
But the subsequent witness that Mr. Reese called was there at the conclusion of the job. He was never asked, Mr. Iden, did you complete all the punch list work? Do you know whether the punch list work was completed? There is absolutely no evidence in the record.
Is there another contractor hired to complete the work?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence that there was?
There was no evidence in the record about who completed the work, Your Honor.
On your theory, the work's still not complete.
No, my theory is the fact that the work is complete does not prove that Kiska completed the work. Again, it's a burden of proof issue, and the issue before the Board of Contract Appeals was on the record as a whole, was the board able to determine that Kiska proved that they completed the work? And the fact of the matter is that faced with that conundrum, the board determined that they didn't complete the work.
Well, if you're right that they never claimed to have completed the work, there may be a problem. Let's assume for the moment that on rebuttal we'll find out there was something that amounts to a claim that they completed the work. Suppose you have a punch list of 100 items, and you say, well, they didn't complete the work. Are they supposed to go fetch and find out which ones you think were not completed, or are you supposed to tell them which ones were not completed?
If we were making a claim for set-off for completing the work for the cost of not completing the work, we would certainly have to tell them. The issue here is not... The issue is the fact that Kiska never put any evidence in that they completed the work or, as the board found, presented a certificate to that certifying. Again,
Is a certificate something they generate or something they get from you saying
no,
you've done the work?
So I'm sorry, Your Honor. They present a certificate of final, a certificate, a voucher seeking final payment stating that all the work is completed and that all the claims are resolved. They submit that to the contracting officer as part of seeking final payment. They did not do that. They did not do that until after the board found that they didn't do that. They submitted it after the they both submitted it and created it after the ASBCA rendered their decision. It's our view that because the review in this court is limited to the record before the BCA, that that can't be even considered by this court.
What's the derivation of the term punch list?
It's a contractual term of art. It's not a contractual term of art. It's a industry term of art.
Well, yeah, I know. I've heard of it. I just wonder what the derivation of it. Do you know?
I'm afraid I'm not. I don't know, Your Honor.
And who draws that up?
Generally drawn up by the owner, yeah. In this case, WMATA.
The owner goes through and decides what's not finished or up to snuff or has to be corrected or what?
Correct.
Is there any kind of limit on the monetary cost of what gets put on a punch list?
Well, substantial completion, the contract defines substantial completion as the project being largely finished and ready for you. So obviously if you were half done, you would not get to
see. The punch list consists of minor items because it's only prepared after there's been a certificate of substantial completion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But again, in a $47 million contract, the punch list could be substantial.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Well, I think we've dealt with the payment issue. I would like to turn to the tunnel lock issue. I think it's clear that the contract required that KISCA provide safe access and egress to the site. KISCA proposed that workers use the same tunnel invert, essentially the floor, that's used by the muck train and other haulage equipment. This is a tunneling job, so there was dirt. As the tunnel progressed, dirt had to be taken out. That's done by a train. WMATA contended that that did not meet the requirements for safe egress and access, and there had to be a tunnel safety walk. And in fact, shut down the contracting officer shut down the work until KISCA built that safety walk. KISCA did not submit a claim for that for 2 years. At the end of the job, for 2 years until 1997, nearing the end of the job. The record, again, is that KISCA has the burden of proof. This is an affirmative claim to show that WMATA changed the contract. WMATA's interpretation was that it was required. KISCA's interpretation was that it wasn't. Again, it's their burden to prove that it wasn't required by the contract and was therefore extra work. There's nothing in the record that shows that WMATA agreed that this was changed work.
Isn't it the usual procedure that a change order is drawn up before the whatever the work encompassed in it is completed?
Ideally, yes, before the work is done, you issue a change order and negotiate the cost.
Here the work was done, eventually.
Well, KISCA had to construct the tunnel safety walk for us to lift the stop work order. So, yes, there was a tunnel safety walk.
And this PO or PCO 56 controversy erupted after the work was completed?
Substantially after the work was completed. The stop work order was in 1995. KISCA submitted the claim in 1997.
Okay. And is it the usual situation that when the proposed change order is drawn up, it's drawn up by, in this case, it would be drawn up by WMATA?
WMATA would issue the modification.
Right. But the question of amount for the whatever the work is that's entailed was a subject of negotiation.
Well, the contractor submits his claimed costs, and those are reviewed.
Right, right. But the fact that WMATA draws up the proposed change order is an admission of liability for whatever the cost of the change is. It admits it's a change.
If WMATA admits that there's a change, then the contractor's entitled to the actual costs incurred to perform that work.
And wasn't the evidence here that that there was a change order drawn up, but that the amount was never agreed upon?
No, Your Honor. The evidence is that there was potentially a pending change order created by the resident engineer. There is no pending change order in the record. The references to a PCO 56 are in some meeting minutes. In the first meeting minute and meeting
minute. How do these things get numbered?
They're sequential.
Sequential. So there's a 55 and there's a 57.
Correct.
Okay.
The first reference is in a meeting, and it talks about settling the claim, similar to the settlement of a claim on a adjacent contract. And both the board and the district court address that. And they address that first in terms of the fact that a settlement is not an admission. And it's clear it's a settlement because the memo that Kiska relies upon says to settle it for $50,000. In this case, Kiska alleges that WMATA offered a $77,000 settlement. If WMATA thought that this was a change, WMATA would not have offered $77,000, which is about a third of what they're asking for. It's a little less than a third. It's more like a quarter of what they're asking for. They're asking for almost $250,000. We would have offered them what their actual costs were. But this is a settlement issue, and it shouldn't even be admitted into evidence because the fact that we decided to settle potentially or arguably decided to settle a claim is not evidence of our liability, certainly when our offer is substantially less than.
Well, I just wonder if it's more subtle than that. That's why I asked the questions. If you draw, for every change order that you draw up that the parties then meet about, there's always a negotiation, and you could call it a settlement, about the compensation that should go to the contractor. And so, that negotiation has nothing to do with whether you're liable for a change. It only is how much.
Right.
So why shouldn't this situation be treated that way as all other pending change orders are?
Because that's not what the board found, and what we're here to talk
about. Well, I know that's not what they found, but if you take a look at the evidence, particularly JA 104, I think it is, the testimony on that, it sounds like that's what was going on.
Well, the testimony is certainly contested with regard to the tunnel change.
The testimony was what?
It's certainly contested. And the board mentions that Mr. Yearden, who was on the site and issued, well, the contracting officer issued it, but Mr. Yearden was on the project when the stop work order also testified. He never considered it a change. There was never any testimony that WMATA issued a change. The only evidence and only document evidence are meeting minutes which reference a PCO and PROC action.
Is that what, if you could please turn to JA 104.
Yes, Your Honor.
The witness is being asked, says, let's look at PCO number 56, which is the temporary tunnel safety walk, as appears here. You see the amount that Kiska proposed. What is the document that the witness is being shown?
I'm sorry, which line are we on?
14. Look at PCO number 56, temporary tunnel safety walk. You see the amount Kiska proposed, yes. What is that document?
That document is the claim. There was never a PCO issue. There was never a PCO in the administrative record.
I know you said that, but what is that document that the witness is being shown?
If it has a mount in it, it would have been the claim that Kiska submitted.
And where is that in the?
It is not in the joint appendix, Your Honor.
Is it in the record?
It is in the record. It's in Kiska's original claim to the contracting officer.
After that, the witnesses asked, did you get an offer from WMATA as to their willingness to pay PCO 56 in any amount? And yes, we did. We got an offer of $77,000. Why isn't that in line with what I discussed with you as the normal practice, that the PCO is issued and then the amount is negotiable?
Well,
and the issuance of the PCO is an admission of liability.
Well, first, Your Honor, we dispute that a PCO was ever issued. Secondly, this is a settlement offer.
Okay, so we're going around that.
Well, if you admit, if you are convinced that the authority issued a modification that was binding on it, that is that it changed its position that a tunnel walk was required, which is not what either the Board of Contract Appeals or the court found. And that's really the issue again. We've somewhat decided to reshuffle the deck and sit as a trier of fact for the board, who is faced with having to take evidence in a hearing about events that happened more than a decade before that hearing. And the record, which obviously your honors have looked at carefully, has a great deal of witnesses on both sides not recalling what happened.
I think your better answer is that the review is for substantial evidence, and there certainly is one way of looking at this testimony is consistent with the way the board looked at it. Another way is inconsistent, and that a reviewing court can't choose to disregard the evidence supporting the board. So.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask you about JA 172, paragraph 44 of the...
I'm sorry, it was JA 172?
172, paragraph 44.
Yes.
I thought I heard you say that PCO number 56 never issued, but in paragraph 44, about the middle of it, it says, appellant contends in essence that the CO reversed course since WMATA issued PCO number 56. And then says, however, PCO 56 was not a binding contract modification. So it sounds like it did exist. I mean, there was a PCO 56.
Well, if there
and that it issued.
Your Honor, if there wasn't PCO 56, that document does not exist. It's not in the record and was not able to be found by either party.
Well, then what was going on in the testimony?
There is meeting minutes, and those are...
Well, I'm referring to Judge Randolph's directed us to page 104, and the testimony at line 14 is, let's look at PCO number 56. You see the amount that Kiska proposed? Question mark, yes.
But that, Your Honor, that's not a PCO. That's Kiska submitted a claim. That's their claim document. That is Mr. Reese asking Mr. Iden to identify the claim document that Kiska submitted for the tunnel safety walk. That's not there is no PCO in the record. That is uncontroverted.
Was there was whatever he was being asked to look at admitted as an exhibit?
Kiska's claim was admitted as an exhibit, yes.
What's the exhibit number?
The exhibit it's early in the Rule 4, and it will be referenced in the board's decision, so it's not in front of you, Your Honors.
Well, that may be factually correct, but legally it is. Is it not?
Okay. If you look at JA 171, paragraph 42, the last sentence, it references appellant filed a cost proposal dated 11 February 97, seeking $247,392 to perform the work. That's in Rule 4, Tab 3.
Do you think that's what he was referring to?
That's the only document where price is ever discussed with PCO 56, with the tunnel safety walk.
And then the next paragraph, 43, says, insofar as pertinent, the meeting minutes state that WMATA was to issue a pending change order, PCO, on the tunnel walkway. And then the next paragraph says that the appellant claims the CO reverse course since WMATA issued PCO. So it sounds like first WMATA was to issue it on July 23rd, 1997, and after this, I think, December meeting or negotiations or something, by the time of the hearing that's recapped in paragraph 44, appellant argues that WMATA changed course or reverse course since it issued. I don't know whether since means in terms of temporal or causation, but anyway, it does say WMATA issued PCO number 56 and even says it was not a binding contract modification. but must have existed at some point.
Well, Your Honor, the first reference is to a meeting minutes where it's reported in those meeting minutes that WMATA wanted to deal with the resolution of this by settling it similar to another contract, and that it said and according to those meeting minutes, it would be issued. It didn't say that it was issued.
Right, was to be issued, right.
In subsequent meeting minutes, and I'm looking for those quickly, there's references to a PCO 56 and action. But there is no PCO 56, and what, again, the board found was that a pending change order in and of itself is not a contract modification. WMATA has to have someone authorized to issue a contract change, issue that change. And the fact that the parties may have considered settlement of this claim does not establish that WMATA, that this wasn't additional work. And again, what the board said was that there had to be safe egress to the site. And Kiska, the record is clear, Kiska never offered any solution that would give safe egress to the site. The board also distinguished why it rejected the tunnel safety claim from, say, the streetcar track claim, where there also wasn't a PCO, because, for instance, in the streetcar track claim, WMATA executed an agreement of final quantities, and the streetcar tracks were a unit price element of the contract. We didn't know at the time of bidding how many streetcar tracks there might have to be removed, so there was a unit price. If the number exceeded the estimate, we would pay if it didn't. In this instance, there was clearly a document signed by WMATA for the additional quantity, and therefore the board was able to find on other evidence that WMATA had agreed to pay for the additional streetcars.
On the question whether this tunnel walkway was in fact a modification of the contract, is that before us, that issue?
Whether it was a modification, absolutely, Your Honor. The board found that WMATA did not agree that it was a change. And again,
I know WMATA didn't agree. Kiska says it was. Is that an issue before this court about whether it was in fact a modification?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
It is.
What the board found was that Kiska failed to prove its entitlement to the claim, and what they needed to prove was that this was not a contract requirement, that it was in fact additional work that they were not required to perform. It was WMATA's position, clearly, since we issued a stop work order, a very serious action, that this was required to maintain safe access and egress to the site. WMATA never changed that position.
But WMATA also never said there's no PCO 56, but as far as I can tell, WMATA never said we're not issuing one because this isn't a modification.
Well, again, it's not clear whether one was issued. There's only references in a few meeting minutes.
If one was issued, wouldn't it be a modification?
No, a pending change order is not a modification.
Because it's not the change order itself?
Correct.
Well, okay, a change order. Let's say you issued a change order. You issue both a pending change order and a change order?
Well, no. For instance, Your Honor, I'm flipping through. There is actually a change order in the record. It's JA040. And that's a change order that's signed by the contracting, in this case, the contracting officer's representative, because it's a small change order of $6,000 and within his authority. In this instance, because it was $247,000 or more. Would have been signed by the contracting officer, but that's a change order. And what the board found with regard to this, for instance, is that the parties executed the change order and therefore WMATA was bound. There is no change order. More importantly, there's no PCO. We don't know who issued it. Did they have authority to do it? Why did they do it? The fact of the matter is, again, this is a burden of proof case. Kiska is the claimant here. Kiska's coming to the board and saying, I have two claims, I'm entitled to payment. Tainage, the contract says you have to finish all the work and you have to submit a voucher. They didn't prove that they finished the work. They didn't submit a voucher. With regard to the tunnel safety wall claim, they have to prove that that was additional work not required. What the board said was, how are you going to have safe access and egress to the site? The only thing that Kiska said is, we'll have our workers use the same space as the heavy haulage equipment. The board said, that doesn't show that you did extra work, that the tunnel safety walk was extra work. Again, this is an issue of, does the board's decision based on the evidence as a whole support the decision, not whether someone else sitting at another time looking at the evidence saying, I believe that Kiska did meet their burden. Now, we don't think that mere references in unsigned meeting minutes that we don't even know occurred, because if you look at the testimony from the witnesses, no one even remembers attending any of these meetings, or if they do, they don't remember what happened. Kiska's sole evidence on this is some mentions in meeting minutes, and as WMATA again contends, the alleged decision to settle this matter. WMATA was, as this court is aware from its previous decision, in substantial litigation with Kiska. So it's quite possible that the parties could have decided to resolve small claims by settlement to keep the and focus on the big issues which were being currently litigated in the U.S. District Court in a $30+ million lawsuit. The evidence just isn't clear, and that's again what the district court found. The district court said, the evidence isn't clear, could have stacked up either way, but my job is reviewing this is limited, and I have to look to see what the board found, and as long as that can be supported by the evidence, it's not my job to reweigh it. It's not, even if I think it, even if I think it's incorrect, as long as it's justified by the record, the board's findings are entitled to finality.
Mr. Laffert, did the district court in any way predicate its decision on what you've said is Kiska's failure ever to timely submit a claim that it had completed all the work?
The district, I'm sorry, I don't understand. District court affirmed the ASBCA's findings that Kiska failed to establish that it completed the work.
Right, but if the problem was that Kiska never submitted the voucher, you wouldn't have to go any further than that by your account.
Well, that was one of the reasons that the ASBCA found that Kiska had not met its burden under 7F of the contract.
Okay, where is that? And then does it show up again in the district court's opinion?
Well, in the district court's opinion, it's... unfortunately, I have a Lexis version, but it looks like it's right at the bottom of page 50 of the reported, it's page 15 of the decision. There's a claim for retainage. It's the last paragraph of the claim for retainage. With regard to the board's decision.
How's the paragraph begin?
The paragraph begins, Kiska identified evidence in the record that might support a finding that all the work was required by the contract. All the work required by the contract was completed by Kiska. However, Kiska's evidence does not compel that conclusion. If anything, Kiska's arguments demonstrate that the record is unclear as to whether Kiska ever completed the work on the punch list.
Okay, that's at, I think, 222 of our JA. Yes, it is. Okay, and the court says, indeed, Kiska concedes in its reply brief that, quote, there is nothing in the record to indicate what punch list work remained as of June or July 1998. Now, from that, the court turns to what it describes as Kiska's attempt to shift the burden to WMATA. But if that's all there is, that there's nothing in the record to indicate what punch list work remained, that doesn't really pick up the board, say the point you said the board made, that there's no claim that no work remained. There's no claim that all the work was done.
We have a lot of double negatives in that sentence.
All right. Well, let's go to what the board said then, and we'll follow it from there.
The board begins its discussion on JA 183 towards the bottom of the page where it discusses the merits and, of course, references Article 7F of the contract.
The last sentence, I think, of the first paragraph under the merits, is that where you want to put us?
Well, it's sort of the middle. To address your question about the evidence, it says appellant failed to show it fully completed the contract work or that WMATA finally accepted the work or agreed to something less than full performance. Again, it's an issue of burden of proof. Kiska's coming to the ASBCA and saying, ASBCA, I'm entitled to the retainage. And the ASBCA is saying, did you finish the work? And you know what? There's nothing in the record. No one ever says on Kiska's side, hey, we got all the work done. In fact, Judge Delman asked Mr. Price, did you finish the work? And Mr. Price says, I don't know. Mr. Iden, who Kiska claims...
He says, I don't know who finished the work.
Correct.
Not that I don't know if it was finished, just I don't know who finished it.
Correct. He also alludes to the fact that it might have been finished by someone other than Kiska. We don't know.
That's a possibility, right. But WMATA has never claimed that that was the case. It's never said what was left undone. It simply is rested, I guess, on, at least it seemed to be now resting, on Kiska's failure to say we did everything. Correct. Although that's the gravamen of their whole complaint.
Correct, Your Honor. I'm here before you on the record that was before the BCA and here to defend the decisions of the BCA under the substantial evidence test. We don't have to look beyond what the board looked at.
Unless the district court erred in its analysis of the burden of proof, or more specifically, the burden of coming forward. Right, then it would be for the district court to revisit the board's decision with that in mind.
If WMATA were making an affirmative claim, yes, Your Honor. If we were seeking to make an affirmative claim, we did not make an affirmative claim.
Well, wait a minute. Does that mean to say we didn't ever say that there wasn't work left undone? Is that what you mean by you're not making an affirmative claim?
Well, I'm addressing the issue that we discussed earlier, distinguishing the case that you cited, which is that in that instance, it appears that the government was making a claim of set-off. That is, we completed the work and we're entitled to keep some of your money. We didn't make that argument. We did not make any argument. Kiska didn't.
Right,
Kiska
you're resting on the burden of proof.
Correct, Your Honor.
And if the burden of proof was incorrectly understood by the district court, then that has to be revisited. By the way, in the PCL case, which you might want to look at and perhaps submit something on later today, the sequence of events is PCL requested final acceptance inspection. The government rejected the request. PCL withdrew its request for a final acceptance inspection and requested a consolidated deficiency listing. The government provided PCL with a consolidated deficiency listing. The government also reminded PCL of its obligation to provide a written certification that the contract work had been completed in accordance with contract section whatever. PCL never provided the required written certification. Instead, it filed a breach of contract claim with the contracting officer. Government notified PCL it was retaining money pursuant to its interpretation of the contract. PCL requested a release of the retainage. Contracting officer issued a final decision denying the breach of contract claim, and then PCL submitted a certified claim for the monies retained by the government, notified the government that it performed the contract and was entitled to the retained money. So there, at some point the contractor said we've claimed it had done all the work. And that was really what was in dispute, and the court said, well, it's the government's obligation to come forward with what was not completed and the dollar value of it. Now I realize you're saying, well, that's some sort of an affirmative claim. I'm not sure exactly how, since it's responding to this claim. But if you want to review the case firsthand during the rest of the later in the day.
I certainly will, Your Honor. But the big difference, I think, there is that PCL said that it completed the work. Here, Kiska never said it completed the work.
Well, I don't think they were just bringing the action for fun. I mean, isn't that the nature of the action?
That doesn't dispense your burden, Your Honor.
Okay. Anything further?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Reese, how much time does Mr. Reese have? Give him 2 or 3.
I'd like to clear a number of things up, but first I'm going to turn immediately to the issue of PCO 56. Let me say...
Remember, you have limited time. Okay.
I know. The problem here is that this is a matter of contract interpretation. It is not a situation in which OSHA said that you must construct an erected walkway in order to meet our requirements. The contracting officer initially determined that, in his view, that sort of construction was necessary. But there is presented in evidence the meeting of July 23, 1997 by the contracting officer and his staff only, in which the contracting officer says, I made a mistake. This is really a change. And my interpretation was wrong. He didn't use those words, but what he did is he took CPN 124, which was the contractor's claim, and he modified that to create pending change order 56. Now, pending change order 56 appears in a number of the closing minutes in that the parties discussed PCO 56. And in addition to that, there is a reference made to the fact that the contracting officer directed his procurement division to negotiate that change. And the $77,000 is not a question of settlement. The $77,000 is basically that the procurement division representative was following the dictates of the contracting officer in negotiating the amount of that particular change. That's all that it was, and that's precisely what the evidence shows in the record. And indeed,
I want to be clear. I just looked again at your statement of issues, and I don't find a claim that the change or the tunnel walkway that was constructed in fact was a modification of the contract.
No, if Your Honor pleases. What is described in the record is the procedure. The procedure is one in which the contractor initially makes a claim. It's given a CPN number. And by the way, that's...
I think you misunderstood. I'm saying in your statement of issues, there is no claim that the modification in fact was, or that the construction of the walkway, in fact, was a modification.
You're absolutely correct, because we're
relying on the procedure for the pending change order 56 and then the negotiations about the amount.
Well, it's more than that, because remember there was PCO 34 and 45 and they were negotiated. They used other documents to make a determination to create modification to the contract. The pending change order is a preliminary step, and that leads to modification, ultimately, when the parties agree on the amount. That's all that we're talking about at that juncture.
Mr. Reese, Mr. Laffert said there's really no place in the record where Kiska claims to have done all the work. Is there anything you can point us to?
Well, basically, if you go back to the district court, and although it's late, there was a voucher submitted because we had taken the position that it was a fruitless act. But when you review both the fact that WMATA had an obligation under the requirements of the Armed Services Board to submit all documents in which it says were relevant and pertinent to the claims, and there's no reference made whatsoever to any incomplete punch list work. And indeed, as I said earlier, when you speak in terms of timeliness of the job, timeliness only arises after the job is 100% complete. And there is a difference, if I may answer Judge Randall's question. Judge, substantial completion is when a project is usable. That's the term at law that is deemed. That's normally found when the contract is 99-point-some-percent complete, but it's usable. 100% means that it's complete. 100%, nothing more to be done. What you have here with respect to this situation is that the parties really believe that the job was 100% complete. It's been in use. There's never been a statement made, and you haven't heard this attorney say anything about any type of work that still remained to be performed. And indeed, in the first lawsuit, their work counterclaims, all of which were withdrawn with prejudice, interestingly enough. There's nothing to have indicated to anybody that there was an issue with respect to complete or incomplete punch list work because it was deemed to be complete by all the parties. Even when you look at the record as to what WMATA was doing in connection with those matters.
And was one or more of those counterclaims for incomplete work?
No. Oh, in the first case? Yes, sir.
It was?
Yes. And interestingly enough, they were severs, really very small stuff, which related to the amount of water that was taken and put into municipal sewers with respect to correcting of the quarters which had been rented by Kiska. I mean, there's nothing at all pertaining to that. And all I'm saying is that notwithstanding the statement that you have heard that there was no actual punch list, all the references are in the closing minutes. And I can tell you without equivocation that I went through the records and I would find files that would be 53, 54, 55, 57, no 56, and the same in other things. But they adopted, the courts below adopted PCO 34 and adopted PCO 45. And we put in actual proof as to what the costs were and the reasons why we did not accept the $77,000 offer.
Judge Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Reese. We have your argument. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you for giving me the time, sir.
Case is submitted.